Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Adrian Gore. Adrian is the founder and chief executive officer of Discovery Limited, which offers life and health insurance, medical aid administration, science-based wellness programs, credit cards, and investment products. Based in South Africa, Discovery has operations in over 23 countries, including the United Kingdom, China, Japan, Canada, and the United States, and has over 17.8 million clients globally. Discovery is best known for its Vitality Life and Health Insurance, the world's first behavioral medical insurance, whose business model incentivizes people to be healthier. In this interview, Adrian discusses why and how he founded Discovery in South Africa in 1992. As the country was going through dramatic changes, Adrian saw an opportunity in the health insurance market as there was a shortage of doctors, extreme inequality, and a dramatic rate of medical inflation. He set his company apart by using concepts of behavioral economics and incentives to create Discovery's unique business model. Since then, he's reaped the advantages of being years ahead in behavioral data collection and has grown his organization beyond its origins in health insurance into life insurance and behavioral banking as well. We also discuss how Discovery went beyond South Africa and into other countries through strategic partnerships, starting with an expansion into the United Kingdom. Beyond that, Adrian shares his outlook and hope for the South African market. Adrian Gore, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Peter, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
No, the pleasure's mine, I assure you. Well, I wanted to, Adrian, to take you back to the and take our listeners to the back to the founding of your company, Discovery, in South Africa in 1992. You were, I believe, half dozen years out of your university experience. You were it was a time, it was still 2 years before the end of apartheid, a time of great change within your country. What a time to start a business. Can you talk a bit about the genesis of Discovery and why you felt the time was right to launch a business in 1992?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Peter. The country was going through quite dramatic change, as you say. Nelson Mandela had been let out of prison in 1990, and the country is moving towards democracy. Healthcare and health insurance is a sort of a microcosm in any society of really what's going on. And at the time, there was really a dramatic rate of medical inflation. So healthcare inflation was really twice price inflation. The health insurance companies of the time were battling, and I spotted an opportunity to start a specialist health insurer in South Africa, and I had this kind of very basic idea that if it was built on rigorous sort of actuarial financial principles and really used the latest thinking, I could create with a team a sustainable health insurance company, so to speak. I guess the interesting development was that, you know, with too few doctors, we have way less doctors per thousand lives than, you know, developed countries like the US or the UK. Terrible disease burden, the highest rate of HIV, so both infectious and non-infectious diseases. And then government was intent, and I think rightly so, on an egalitarian, almost Obamacare kind of regulation of no discrimination, not turning people away. But when you put those things together, the ability to actually offer insurance on a sustainable basis was very difficult. You couldn't turn people away. You couldn't manage the care because there were too few doctors for an insurer to have any leverage. So we had this very simple insight, and that was to focus on making people healthier. In other words, the simple hunch that if we could get people to be healthier, we could reduce the demand for healthcare, we could keep the risk pool inside the insurance company more solid, and we could offer a sustainable product. So the sort of the unique, almost the complexities of the South African environment at the time gave rise to a very simple purpose, make people healthier. And so the company was started on this vision of mixing complex actuarial principles, but with a very simple vision of making people healthier, and then the simple idea of incentivizing people to be healthy, in effect. And that really was the start in 1992, 1993.
And I would love to understand more about the incentives, because there are a lot of organizations who recognize in the health industry who recognize that cost is driven by a lack of health. And so trying to provide incentives for people to get healthier and therefore reduce the cost burden to the enterprises and the industry more generally speaking, is an important avenue to take, but has been proven to be very difficult for many organizations. What have you done that's different?
You know, I would argue, and I hope it doesn't sound self-serving, at the time when we did this, it was actually, there was very little data around prevention really working. So this was still a time of a lot of infectious diseases where certainly actuarially there was a belief that risk is often pre-existing. You know, you have a kind of a risk profile that gets priced in, and that's your position. And so the use of incentives in the early 90s or the late 80s was not something that was done. There was also very little understanding of behavioral economics, in other words, how people respond to decision-making, why they have certain biases about why they make choices. You know, Daniel Kahneman and the idea of loss aversion and all that stuff was only starting to evolve at that stage. So I'd say it was interesting. We started out, we actually, the initial idea came out of a very successful gym chain that we wanted to incorporate into our health plan. And we had this simple idea of, you know, you could earn going to this gym in effect by doing healthy things. That would be the incentive. And so we embarked on that journey. I think that we, from the get-go, had a very, very deep sense of making the incentives profound, of pricing them into the insurance product, so to speak, that the two would be linked. Even though in those days at the start, the technology was pretty rudimentary, but we made the incentives not honor-based. In other words, you had to demonstrate through, you know, we measured going to the gym, going for preventive screening. We measured these activities through technology, although it was pretty clunky then. But, you know, we tied ourselves into the gym chains, and when you went through the turnstile, our systems kind of picked that stuff up. So I think that the rigor of the incentives, I think the technology that made sure it was properly verified activities, and because of that we could offer real valuable incentives, created a integrated model, certainly in health insurance, that was very, very successful. And so I think you're right. I think many organizations have tried over time, but I think, you know, this is like 20 years ago where we started to do this. And I do think the mix of scale, rigor, verified, and applying more and more science to the data as it emerged has made us very successful on that basis.
Yeah, that makes sense. And as you were a pioneer in this space and have been collecting data for such a period of time, does that also give you, fast forwarding today, we'll go back a little bit as I want to cover further the evolution of your business, but has that given you a data advantage now just because of the long time and the gross amount of data that you've been able to collect in the interim?
Listen, I've no doubt we have a considerable lead on the data side, not to say that doesn't impede others from doing the same. You know, we have about 50 million life years of data, so we really understand, I think, quite deeply both causality and correlation to certain behavior types and the effect on mortality curves and sickness curves, and I think we know how those things relate to one another. We've applied this similar data techniques to credit default in our credit card business, understanding behavioral impacts and how they correlate to credit defaults. We've done the same with how people drive and, you know, fatality rates and accident rates. So we developed a very rigorous way of thinking about the so-called shared value model and exactly how you measure the data and how you understand causality and the correlations. I think you need to know both. We have over time published a lot of papers, and, you know, last year with Apple, with the Apple Watch benefit and how that works, we published a study with Rand. We've done the same this year on physical activity and its impact on economic growth. So we are more and more trying to not only, build the platform globally, we're trying to influence a narrative about how the data can, in fact, impact society. So the data is pretty paramount to everything we do. But there are four silos to the model, data being one of them. And I do think it is a very powerful piece of it.
And I'm also curious, what drew you to behavioral economics? This is a field that has, you mentioned, Danny Kahneman, actually a psychologist, but very highly influential on the behavioral economics space, obviously I shouldn't say obviously, but for those who may not know, won an economics Nobel Prize, in fact, despite the fact that that was not his primary discipline. But I wonder what drew you to that at such an early stage. As I say, today, there's so much that is written, so many books that have been written about the power of behavioral economics and awards granted as the one I just mentioned. But what drew you initially to the insight of drawing from that discipline and applying it to business?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, as I said, I think when we started, we had this hunch of incentivizing better health. We had no idea of the depth of the science that we were kind of somehow, you know, stepping into. But what's intriguing about it is it's become clear that there's just a few behaviors, like three key behaviors: smoking, eating badly, being physically inactive, that drive four conditions that drive 50% of mortality and 80% of the disease burden. You know, so the science kind of showed that quite quickly. The intriguing question for us is always, as we kind of evolved, was trying to understand why people just make choices that are really bad for them. You know, when you start to delve into that, you quite quickly get into the behavioral economics, that people are, you know, instant gratification, this idea of hyperbolic discounting. People discount the future at high rates of interest. They don't care about the future. You know, the issue of loss aversion and all of that stuff has become an evolving part of our business. So I think one of the really successful attributes of the discovery story has been mixing that behavioral economics, so understanding that stuff as much as we can, with a more hardcore actuarial, you know, that isn't at all emotional. You know, it's financial and statistical, and it's bringing those two together. You know, if you, the model, I think, Peter, globalized well, because the issue, the nature of the sort of three things that I think drove us. One is the understanding of behavior, that in most of these, most financial services silos, whether it's banking, motor insurance, health insurance, life insurance, or just a few behaviors drive the risk. And I think that emerged quickly for us. The other is technology, obviously, that as an enabler. And the other is purpose. I think what happened to us as well, besides the behavioral economics, was this idea of make people healthier. Initially, 20 years ago, it sounded like, you know, I'd go do presentations to analysts and to stakeholders, and this guy, you know, I think this guy's an idiot. It sounds like a soft idea, you know. But today, with purpose and with things like ESG, and, you know, our model is more and more shared value, that's what it is, it resonates well. So we've had kind of an evolution. I don't think there's been, you know, one or two epiphanies. It's been a very, very, how can I say, it's been a very strong evolution of, you know, that's globalized because of three mega trends that we somehow, I think fortunately, just got sucked into.
Yeah, very interesting. And I would love to talk about that evolution of your business. You talked about the evolution from health into life, into car insurance, motor insurance, now into banking. Can you talk a bit about how the organization has grown, how one opportunity has led to the next, and the connection points you were making?
You know, as I said, our genesis was health insurance, and we developed a health insurance company, Discovery Health, initially in 93. The vitality link and its sort of foundational effect made us incredibly successful. And I have to say, I think the strength of the model is it didn't have a trade-off. You know, if you get it right, it's great for customers, great for us, it makes us profitable, and it's great for society. So no one ever complained about this idea of make people healthy, incentivizing better health. So we kind of got going on an incredibly positive track that appealed to all people. And we always stressed the concept, and, you know, in countries now that we operate, it's actually law, but at the time, this is not about healthy people, it's about making people healthier. You know, so this is about, regardless of your risk factors, this is about getting you to behave differently and improve those factors and pricing them in to the financial services model. But we came across the life insurance industry. Most of us were, you know, life insurance trained actuaries. And what was interesting is the model, I mean, I don't bore you with this stuff, but the model is really quite bizarre. You get underwritten, you know, you apply for insurance, and at that point in time, you go through a medical and you fill out all these application forms, and then you pay a premium that's fixed for the next 40 years, right? And, you know, I mean, in a world where we're finding out that 60% of the risk is, in fact, behavioral, during the currency of the policy you've bought, pricing someone at a point in time just kind of doesn't work. It worked, you know, 50 years ago when things were entirely pre-existing in how we manage risk. So we saw that we could offer life insurance in a way where your premiums could flex as you engaged in the program, so to speak. So offering people a lower price entry point and then letting the cost of the insurance drift down, in fact, if they engaged, or drift up if they didn't engage. So giving them control over their behavior just resonated so well. And we the South African market, that is, it's actually a very, very innovative market for insurance, because the public sector here is does not provide to that part of the market. So in effect, the entire social security system is provided by the insurance industry. So we really disrupted that market here and became kind of the biggest life insurer by new business sales fairly quickly. But then we also, over time, I'm jumping, you know, many years, just to give you a sense, but on the life insurance side, we then, you know, went to Asia with AIA, into Japan with Sumitomo, into Europe with Generali, on exactly the same model, in the US with John Hancock. So the model really repeated and scaled across many markets because of it's incredible. It's almost intuitively obvious, although it's actually quite complex to the customer. It's really good value. So the life insurance jump really was really good for us. Then we, as I think you said in the outset, this concept of health, we took the view that if we can make people's lives healthier, so reduce motor vehicle accidents in our country here, that is a really substantial cause of death and disability. So we applied the same model to trying to make people drive better. And the presence of telematics in those devices were being used more for almost a pay-as-you-drive insurance model. We saw the opportunity to use these sophisticated pieces of technology to actually know how people drive, how they accelerate, how they brake. And, you know, we really got involved in the data. We got a guy on our board, Rory Byrne, actually was on Michael Schumacher's Ferrari team, you know, to help us think through the telematics and the way people drive and apply that to the data. So we developed an insurance model where, in effect, if you drive better, safer, you earn vitality points, exactly like the health system. The points give you a status, and the status gives you all kinds of benefits. In this case, we offered gas or fuel at a discounted price. So we created this shared value motor insurance model. Again, it really did well. And then, you know, over the last, we had a credit card business that we did with a bank. It was very successful. And we saw the correlations between how people behave on the health side and how their credit tends to perform. In other words, and I think the science shows us that people that are disciplined, in other words, they can avoid some instant gratification in managing their health well, tend to do similar things, not dissimilar things, with their money. So if you can somehow predict how people behave, you can apply that to elements of banking. And so, you know, over the last 5 years, we've been building what we call the behavioral bank, this concept of offering a very sophisticated fintech bank, but its real reason is to offer people incentives to manage their money well and reward them for doing that. So it's been an evolution across a number of industries and across a number of geographies, but in fact done off exactly the same shared value model. And it's, as I say, it's scaled from China to across the world to 23 countries today.
And you mentioned that the entry point in many of those countries has been through partnership. Can you talk a bit about how you've established those partnerships and the similarities or even the differences between them that might be representative of the variations of the different markets you've entered?
We were approached by the Prudential, the UK Prudential, which is a absolutely giant insurer in the UK. This is like around 2004, 2005, around building a health insurer on the shared value chassis in the UK. That led to a partnership that was very successful. We built the health and then the life insurance product, and then we over time bought that partnership out, and it became a primary market for us. So Vitality in the UK is a life and health insurance company, but it taught us, I think, a lot about partnerships. And the CEO of the Pru actually went to Asia and took AIA out of the AIG stable, you know, after the financial crisis. One of the things that was done, you may recall this, is AIA was listed, was really sold to the public markets out of AIG, and it became the largest listing in Hong Kong. The CEO of the Pru, a guy, Mark Tucker, did the AIA CEO role. He did an absolutely brilliant job. And he and I had worked together at the Pru, and he said, listen, why, you know, this thing could work across Asia. Let's think about it in the AIA context. So him and our team started working through how this could work. And I think that the learnings about partnering, getting to your point, it's actually a, it needs to be a corporate competence. I mean, it does require specific behavioral, how can I say, attributes. You know, it really does, between two corporates, different value systems, making sure there's trust. And we really worked hard on making sure that not only did the product work, but we could actually partner well. We partnered with Ping An in China, where we own 25% of their health insurance business. They're probably the most powerful insurance company in the world today. And applied similar kinds of issues. And then we actually figured out this model could repeat through partnerships. So, as I said, we worked with John Hancock and Manulife in North America on a similar basis, and that has been really, really successful. And we've repeated the same, and it has been through partners and a very strong belief in partnering with, how can I say, almost national champions, great companies in their market, Sumitomo in Japan, Generali in Europe. And then we're doing more and more in smaller markets. But the idea is exactly the same. So we're applying a discipline to the behavioral chassis of Vitality. So it's AIA Vitality or John Hancock Vitality or, you know, wherever you go, it has that brand. So we've applied discipline to how it looks. And then we've applied one piece of technology across the world into this platform where more and more all of the partners sit. So we really have created this platform structure upon which all of this resides and the partners sit. And we've created a Vitality network that I think today is probably 35% of the world's, the companies that sit on the platform represent 35% of the world's covered population. So it's given us considerable, you know, how can I say, considerable one-to-one relationships with, I think, great people and great companies, but it's given us a network of considerable scale, you know, and we're doing things more and more as a business that are, we had our Global Vitality Conference in London last 2 weeks ago with all of our partners there, you know, really at the C-suite level, getting the kind of buy into the overall movement that we're creating. So, sorry, it's a long answer. It's just trying to make the point. The focus has been not just on the model, but on careful partnerships and creating a sense of a movement. And it really feels, although this Vitality global initiative is probably about 5-6 years old, it's gaining considerable momentum.
Remarkable. I want to turn to you referenced the bank, which is the most recent entry in the portfolio that you lead within Discovery. I read somewhere that you and your team spent 1.5 million hours integrating 120 systems together. In order to create the platform upon which the bank sits. And in some ways, it seems to me emblematic of the enormous complexity behind the scenes required in order to make this as simple as possible to the customer. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that interplay between the very hard work necessary to make something that is intuitive, easy to use, something, of course, that customers will want to use.
Yeah, no, I think your insight is right. I think to make something simple for the customer does takes complexity behind the scenes. The idea of the bank was really exactly the same model as the idea that you'd incentivize people to change their behavior by virtue of managing their money well. So we used the same architecture, exactly the same architecture, but the complexity was building a Vitality chassis on financial behaviors. You know, so we kind of wanted to almost automate all the sucking in of all the data. So an individual joining the bank with their consent, of course, gives us access to all of their, you know, all the different bits of data so we can understand how they insure their savings, their debt levels, et cetera. And we can give them a Vitality score, so to speak. And they would then be incentivized to do healthy things by way of managing their money. And that would earn them points. But I think the complexity was the value proposition. I mean, the price of banking is really the rate of interest that you pay, and our analog to the other industries we've worked in has been the idea of dynamic interest rates. In other words, if you manage your money well, you'd pay very little interest on borrowings, and you'd earn high rates of interest on savings. In other words, you'd flex rates of interest, and we would integrate you into the reward structures we have elsewhere in our platform. So we'd stack the economic value from life insurance, health insurance, and banking into one set of rewards that offers you really ridiculous discounts on healthy food and, you know, all kinds of things, and give you one currency, a Discovery Miles currency that you can monetize, you can transfer, you know, and it's based on behaviors, you know. So if you manage your money well, or you spend responsibly, or you go for a run, all of that stuff earns you a currency in your bank account. You know, so the actual, I think the bank brought together this, the power of technology, and I think all of the fintech and these neobanks that are coming out. But the concept here was a behavioral bank. It wasn't just a very thin, very basic bank account. It was offering a full stack modern retail bank that would offer the entire range of services on the face of the mobile. But it would be based on behaviors, and if people really, you know, really get value out of creating economic value through behavior change. So on the face of the mobile, you can see all of your bank accounts and you can do some amazing stuff with it, but you can see your vitality discounts as they build up through your behavior. You can track your currencies. So we're trying to make a really cool, easy to use bank on the face of the mobile, but linked underneath it to all of these different worlds. And it's been remarkable. I think it's the most fascinating thing I think we've done. We're very excited about it.
You mentioned partnerships with the likes of Apple, for instance, to get to wearables, no doubt is an even easier way to gather the relevant data that feeds the system that you've described. Can you talk a bit about some of the creative partnerships that you're establishing as you contemplate additional platforms through which both to draw data from customers, but also to interact with them otherwise?
You know, there's a bunch of generic partners in every market we worked with, whether it's health clubs or, you know, healthy food grocers, those kinds of partners. But as technology and the opportunities became more global, the idea of global partnerships to add to the chassis made great sense. One of the things that I think our UK company broke through with was this idea of active rewards. That part of Vitality was almost gamifying physical activity. We called it active rewards. And if you do your weekly steps, you get a coffee from Starbucks. And, you know, we worked with Starbucks in the UK where it was a pretty cool, how can I say, UX. You do your steps and you monitor it and you go get your cup of coffee. I actually thought it wouldn't work. It actually worked unbelievably well. So the rates of engagement in the UK were tremendous. And so we developed partnerships where beside the fulfilling of something like a cup of coffee, the actual, you know, on the face of the mobile, it just works well. It's all integrated and seamless. But we had this idea that with devices coming out, we could monitor physical activity a lot more accurately. And we approached Apple with the idea that working with Apple Watch almost could create both a powerful device to monitor physical activity, but in and of itself, it's a powerful reward. I mean, Apple Watch is an inspirational product. It's a beautiful product. People want to have it, etc. And so we approached Apple with this idea of using the watch as a loss-framed structure. And the simple manifestation of how it worked for the customer was essentially you get the watch almost for free if you're part of Vitality. So you pay a tiny joining fee, you know, I don't know, $10 or $20 or pounds, whatever market it might be in. And then you pay for the watch, in effect, monthly, but the monthly repayments go down as you become physically active. So in other words, if you're meeting your physical activity goals, the monthly installment is zero, right? So every month, depending on your physical activity, your watch repayments really fluctuate. So we created this real loss aversion. You get the watch in effect and you stand to lose it if you don't do your physical goals. The truth is that if you do nothing, you end up paying for the watch over 24 months without interest. So this is not penal stuff. But the truth is that people get remarkably engaged in the program. And together with Apple, we roll this out in a few markets. I mean, in the UK, we've done really well. We've done well with John Hancock in the US with it. It really is an example of a partnership that's easy to globalize, but really has had the most remarkable effect. We rolled out a study with Rand, as I said earlier, with Apple, just showing in three markets, the US, the UK, and South Africa, just the effect that this loss-strain benefit had on physical activity and its sustainability, regardless of gender, geography, risk factors. It was, I think, on average, rates of physical activity went up 34%. So we've done this in a few markets now. Aetna in the US has done this. They've called it Attain. We worked with Apple and Aetna on getting this into their stacks. And I think that's going very well. We're doing it in a number of different places. So that kind of partnership, we're working closely with companies like Apple, has been great for the platform and just for the collection of data. So there are a number of these kinds of partnerships that we've developed. I think they'll get bigger and better as we go on.
That's excellent. I wonder, as you look to the future, your home market, South Africa, as you mentioned, you're now an international firm, to say the least, with the many markets you're now involved in that you've described. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about your thoughts about the South African market and its growth.
The South African market is a complex one. I mean, it's kind of a two-tier economy. It's one of our biggest issues here, the social imperative of just reducing inequalities. You've got this market of probably 10 million people that are in a very developed, you know, economically sound market. I mean, there are all kinds of stresses, but essentially it's like a developed market. And then you've got a tier of 40 million people that are really in an underdeveloped market. The public sector is underfunded, et cetera. So, you know, financial services and insurance particularly is a crucial safety net in a market where you have a lack of often public sector safety net. So it's a complex market, but because of that, it's a fantastic market as a laboratory. You know, it's pretty sizable in and of itself. So we built some really big businesses in the South African market, and we have it's kind of a paradox. I mean, it sounds like a developing market, but the banks are, unfortunately for us as a competitor, they are really well run, they govern well, their technology is first rate. So there's some really sophisticated companies, but the markets and the country has considerable complexity around social pressure and funding gaps and all kinds of things. So it's a market, I think, of scale. It has scale in it, and we built a big business out of it. But it's a market, I think, that's really good for as a laboratory. You know, it's one where these pressures manifest in considerable innovation. So we are proudly South African company, I have to say, but one that I think, just given the experiences here, we can globalize off the base of what we've done.
That's very evident with the results that you've driven. I wonder if you also, as you look to the future, what other trends excite you? You've mentioned a number of them that you are taking advantage of, but I wonder if there are any that you've not yet touched on that particularly excites you as you look to the future.
I think obviously technology goes without saying. It's spreading into every single issue, and that's something we take as a given. And it's something that you can't straddle as one company. I think we kind of use it as an enabler for what we're trying to do. I think the issue of purpose, I know it sounds soft, I think the issue of purpose is gaining considerable momentum. This whole movement on towards ESG and the importance of ESG, I think, is obviously critical. But what we're trying to get to, and I think it's one of the things that does excite us, is the concept of shared value. In other words, if you can build a business that, through its pursuit of profitability, is good for society and shares value, I think you get a very different, instead of, you know, focusing on compliance and ticking boxes and something and things that often increase costs and reduce competitiveness, I'm excited about purpose that actually drives better results, you know, brings prices down, makes you more competitive, makes customers more sticky, gets them engaged in your model. And that's, to an extent, I think, where we've got to in our business, the idea of a shared value insurance or financial services model. Really, although, as I hope I haven't been too long-winded, I think in a number of markets, a number of different industries, the irony is we've got more focus, not less so. So we really have built a shared value platform around doing exactly that across financial services. And I feel very strongly that we can transform financial services, because I think the trend is towards better products that do well by way of the customers they serve, but ones that create value for customers and engage them in something that's positive for them. So I think, you know, the behavioral side, I think the purpose side is very, very powerful for us. It excites me tremendously, and I think we can make an impact. We've actually put out, as a global network with all of our partners, this pledge of making 100 million people more physically active by 2025. So we're doing a lot as a collective to try and do that. It's, we're taking it very seriously. So we really are beside the necessity of shareholders and all the stuff that you need to do as a business, and that's a good thing. We're trying to do things by way of society that really improve the world. And I think as an industry, you know, the insurance industry particularly monetizes better health. You know, we're the only actor beside, I guess, government that actually directly monetizes people being healthier. If you're healthier, we're more profitable. So we have an ability to change society dramatically because we can do that. We can share the value created. So I think that whole issue of purpose and of shared value and taking that and getting it from a fluffier idea into one that is a proper actuarial technology platform that can serve many companies is where we focus.
My last question to you, Adrian, I wanted to ask about how you apply some of these same lessons back to your own life. No doubt they're profound to you. You were immersed in the topic of health in each of your businesses. I wonder how you've brought this to back home, so to say.
So my personal life, I think I had always a deep conviction about fitness and staying healthy. And I'm not sure that influenced me directly in the business, but it must have, I would think, in retrospect. But I've been very, very careful about fitness, about sleep, about nutrition. And it's helped me, I think, really, it's helped me personally scale, you know, and stay focused and intense over 25 years. I believe it very deeply. But I think that, you know, our company is at the cutting edge of, I think, some of the data, the understanding of this stuff. So being exposed to it does give you a deep sense of conviction that, you know, you really can live a better life, you know, and it can be harnessed in a way that I think is very powerful.
Indeed. Well, Adrian Gore, thank you so much for a great conversation, for describing your entrepreneurial journey, the many successes of discovery and the many businesses you're now involved in. A wish of continued success, and thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me on Thursday for a special recording from the recent MetaStrategy Summit. The episode will feature a conversation between MetaStrategy Vice President Alex Krauss and Lowe's Chief Information Officer Sumantini Godbole and Novant Health Chief Digital and Technology Officer Angela Yocum, focused on moving from strategy to execution using business capabilities.